From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Do animals have rights? To what extent do animals participate in the human moral community? How should humankind view its relationship to animals? Those questions are central to an examination of animal rights by one scholar at the National Humanities Center. He is Tom Reagan, a professor of philosophy at North Carolina State University and the author of The Case for Animal Rights, published in 1983 by the University of California Press. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Tom Reagan is working on a new book about the English moral philosopher G.E. Moore. Tom, let's begin with some generalities. You've written a book called The Case for Animal Rights. Tell me in general terms what that case is.
The case involves a number of different areas of thinking. One is the question of what animals are. Mm-hmm. That is, how shall we understand the other animals with which we share the earth? And I limit my attention to a certain class of animals. I don't want to talk about every species of animals. I say, let us just think about mammalian animals, and, uh-huh. and let us, to avoid the problems about fetuses and neonates and so on, let's just think about our paradigm case as a normal one-year-old mammalian animal. Now, what is that animal like? What sort of psychology does it have? And what we find when we look at the history of thought is that a number of important thinkers have denied that they have any psychology. Descartes, the most famous one, he says that animals don't think. They're not aware of anything. You break an animal's paw, a dog's paw, and it doesn't feel a thing. The fact that it barks and whines and cries is just its machine's way of registering that something has gone wrong with the machinery. Well, part of the case for animal rights then involves this attempt to get clear on the psychology of these animals. And what I argue in the earlier parts of the book is that, in fact, they are very complicated, sophisticated psychologies indeed, that they have beliefs and desires, they have preferences, memories, expectations, mm-hmm. a sense of their identity, a sense of the future. These sorts of claims I think I can substantiate. So the point of departure then for making the case for animal rights begins with making the case that they are mm-hmm. fundamentally like us in these psychological ways. Mm-hmm. So not the physiology all by itself, not the behavior all by itself, not anything all by itself, but rather a series of relevant considerations makes the case, I think, for viewing these animals as fundamentally like us in psychological terms, mm-hmm. as having a sophisticated psychology, just overwhelming. And so it's not, in other words, sometimes people will say, oh, well, you're being so anthropomorphic, oh, you're attributing all these characteristics to animals and they belong only to human beings. Well, I think that on the contrary, the people who refuse to attribute these characteristics are the ones we have to worry about, because they fail to see the similarities that are there before mm-hmm. before us if we think carefully about them. I would add this just parenthetically, that in saying this, I'm not saying anything revolutionary or new or original. I think this is a matter of common sense. I think I am speaking for the common sense view of the world in this respect. And also, happily, is a nice case where science and common sense are one voice, mm-hmm. because if you look at the Darwin, for example, as the principal spokesperson of evolutionary theory, what I'm saying is in no way any different from what he said, that we do resemble these animals fundamentally in the respects in which I've enumerated. But again, this is only not yet even to begin to make the case that they have rights. Mm-hmm. This is the starting point, not the ending point.
All right. Well, let's come to that, Tom Reagan. What rights do animals have? Mm-hmm. What are the rights?
Well, one of the points that everybody who's listening wants, I think, to bear in mind is that when someone like myself argues for animal rights, we're not arguing against human rights. On the contrary, in my book, what I do is argue at great length that human beings like you and I have fundamental moral rights, mm-hmm. and that it's then, in my view, because of this fundamental psychological similarity that we share with animals, mammalian animals, that they too have as much claim to fundamental moral rights as you and I do. Now, the fundamental right that I argue in the case of you and I and the other folks listening, is what I call the right to be treated with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And what this amounts to, if I could put it like this, is this, that you don't exist for me. You're not my resource. You're not something for me to use as I go through life trying to promote my welfare against your will. We can reach some accommodation, perhaps. I can hire you to fix my plumbing or to paint my house or whatever, or to fix my car.
But I'm not the center of it all.
That's
for
right.
You.
You're not the center of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that I use you merely as a thing, merely as a means to my ends, by force or coercion or deceit or something, I fail to treat you with respect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you have a moral space, and I'm not to invade that space by my force or coercion or deceit and so on. If I do, then I abuse and violate your right. Now, I believe that animals, again, the animals that I'm talking about, have as much a claim to that right to be treated with respect as you and I do,
mm-hmm.
because they are as much a subject of a life. They have a life of their own, of importance to them, independently of their importance to me. And the same just as in the case of you, again. You have a life that's important to you, independently
mm-hmm.
of your importance to me. You have that moral space. I'm not to invade it by force, coercion, deceit. Now, the crucial thing then for animals then is I'm not to treat them as if they exist for me, as if they're my resources, not only individually but collectively, as if they're
mm-hmm.
our species' resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so the implications of this, the moral implications of this, are both dramatic, severe, some people think radical. I think that they're just straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
We are not, for example, then to take animals and use them as our models or tools in research laboratories
mm-hmm.
in order to promote our ends, in order to do product testing or to do basic research for that matter, or
well,
to do instructional to teach children how to dissect and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely a violation of their rights.
Tom Regan, we'll come back to some of these implications of the case that you make for animal rights, but how is it that you would address the hierarchy in which animals come to us in a sort of philosophical as well as a cultural legacy? It's always been done this way. Why can't we continue treating animals the way we do?
Well, it hasn't always been done this way in all places and all times. I mean, there has been greatly differing ways of institutions interacting with animals, from Native American interaction with wild animals, for example, on the one hand, to just centuries of vegetarianism in Eastern societies, for example, where animals
uh-huh.
have not been eaten as a matter of conscience.
And, so maybe Americans are the exception rather than the rule.
Well, I think there is some reason to worry about that in any event, but it is the case that you can never argue this way convincingly, to, in my mind, morally anyhow. You can never say, well, we've always done it this way, therefore it's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of defense of the status quo would have justified retaining slavery, would have justified retaining sexual discrimination, and so
right.
on. Well, the same kind of argument, I think, is broken backed in the case of trying to defend how we treat animals. But the thing that I would want to emphasize is that what makes us special also carries with it certain responsibilities. What makes us special, to the extent that I can make sense of this idea anyhow, is that unlike the other animals in the world, we are accountable, can
mm-hmm.
be held accountable for what we do. We have the notion of duty, of right and wrong, of justice and injustice, these familiar moral notions make sense when they are applied to human behavior, don't make sense when they're applied to the behavior of mice and cats and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given that that's the case, given that it does make sense in our case and not in the case of these other animals, then that's what I mean when I say that very difference doesn't give us a blank check to do anything we want to these animals. On the contrary, we have
mm-hmm.
to limit our behavior towards these animals because we are capable of doing it.
Well, now that, Tom Regan, takes us into some of the implications for the case that you make for animal rights. You were careful at the outset of our conversation, I recall, to make certain qualifications and to set up certain little boxes and as I say, categories. Do you do that here? Do you, for instance, what do you argue, what do you think about the use of animals in medical experiments? How do you weigh the perils and rewards, the benefits and the losses?
Right. It's a very important question, increasingly on the public conscience,
mm-hmm.
Increasingly in the media. What the position I advocate comes to is that it is a strict abolitionist position. And that's what I mean by that is
let's
this,
get rid of it.
That what is wrong with animal experimentation isn't this or that experiment. Everybody who takes the time to become modestly informed about what goes on in terms of the use of animals in science, everyone will come away saying, oh, did you read this one? Did you hear about that one? There are horror stories there, and I'm saying nothing that people in science themselves would not admit. But, see, my position is that as bad as those horror stories are, that's not the fundamental wrong. The fundamental wrong is the whole system of animal use in science. And what I mean by that, again, is this, that system is possible, is tolerated, only so long as we think of animals as resources for us.
We're discriminating against them.
That's right. They're here for us.
Sure.
So the system is founded on injustice.
Well, let's pause on this for a moment, Tom Reagan. You're making the case for animal rights. Would you abolish, I suppose it's difficult to philosophize in retrospect, would you abolish the benefits, the inherited medical legacy for the sake of the ill treatment that the animals have received? Would you in turn relegate all of the potential benefits of animal experimentation in terms of humankind? Would you relegate those to, would you do without them in order that animals and humans share this moral compatibility?
Well, you ask a number of different questions, I think, at the same time, and let's see if I can address first one and then another. In terms of the future, I mean, am I saying, well, all right, this is it, this is the end of any kind of basic research, let's shut down everything, no more inquiry into the nature of disease and the prevention of disease and so on? Am I saying that? Of course not. What I'm saying is that...
Well, no, you said that you would stop it, that you're taking an abolitionist...
That's right. But just as, just as when I say, look, you're not to do this to human beings. You're not to take human beings and keep them in cages and experiment on them. That doesn't mean that you're not to do research, not to do science. Well, similarly, what I'm
saying
is... They're
not mutually exclusive.
That's right. It is not anti-scientific to say you're not to use animals. That's not anti-scientific. There are, in fact, all manner of alternatives that are being investigated in ways of doing science that don't involve the use of a whole animal.
Mm-hmm.
These involve mathematical modeling. These involve tissue culture. These involve any number of esoteric but growing fields of inquiry.
How practical are these? In other words, I'm asking, is it merely a question of the convenience for the scientific researcher or experimenter to have a live organism there to work on rather than a mathematical model?
Well, yes and no, I think. See, I don't want to say that it simply is a matter of convenience, although to a very large extent the science is in the grip of habit like anything else.
Right.
And the way you do science tends to be the way you were taught to do it. And the way we've been doing it as a society for the last 100 years or so is by using animals. So, sure, it is a matter of convenience because that's the done thing.
They've become disposable.
That's right. They certainly are disposable. But and so when you have new technologies that are threatening business as usual, then, of course, there's a predictable reluctance to take these things seriously. I don't want to say, and this would be extremely naive for me to say, that if we stopped using animals today, we could do everything we wanted to do without using them tomorrow. I don't think that kind of change comes that quickly, obviously. But there is no reason... A priori, if I can use that expression, there's no reason why just automatically we have to say, well, we cannot get the benefits that we want if we don't use animals. There's, in fact, again, just as sometimes a person like myself is, people say, oh, he's so anti-human, you know, he's such a misanthrope about all this. Well, sometimes I'm accused of being anti-scientific, but nothing could be further from the truth. I think the people who are anti-scientific are the people saying, you can't do it without the animals.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me like the people in Galileo, when Galileo said, I want you to look through the telescope and see what you see. He said, oh, no, we're not going to look because we know what we'll see. You know, they've already made up their mind about things. people who are fighting this rearguard action about, oh, well, there are no alternatives, strike me as the worst enemies of science, mm-hmm. not to be trusted. But again, now to go back to the other sorts of things about the benefits that we have derived from
right, the legacy of medical
legacy,
research.
Right. A lot of this has to be put in perspective. Many of the benefits that we have derived over the last century, the reason that health has improved so much over the last century, is not directly related to the kinds of research that people think of in terms of animal research. Fundamentally, the improvements in health have come about because improvements of hygiene, improvements in diet, improvements in our sanitation, these sorts of things. It doesn't follow from that we haven't received any benefits. I think, in fact, that those people who say that no benefit has ever come from animal experimentation overstate the case. But if we were to say that benefits justify practices, then, of course, we'd have to say, well, it's justified. But I use the expression sometimes called ill-gotten gains, mm-hmm. you know, how you can get some gains but not get them in good ways and get them in unjust ways. In places in the South, I think in the 1930s, prisoners were given syphilis, and the disease was untreated. They didn't treat the disease. They wanted to see what would happen.
Just to see.
And it might be, I think this is conceivable, might have actually happened. Suppose that in the process of doing that, they had learned something, the benefit of future syphilis victims. That would be a gain, that'd be a benefit, it seems to me.
But you're saying that the ends do not justify the means.
Exactly right. Uh-huh. That is, that these gains would be ill-gotten in that case, in the case of human beings, and also then, in my view, in the case of using it on animals. We can't undo what's been done.
Right.
And I'm not saying that we should undo what's been done. What we can do is work very hard to see that it's not repeated if it's wrong to begin with.
You're making a case for a morality of means as well as a morality of ends.
That's correct. That's a nice way to put it, I think. Yeah, that's correct.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about the case for animal rights, the title of a book published in 1983 by one scholar at the National Humanities Center. Professor Tom Reagan teaches philosophy at North Carolina State University. According to Tom Reagan, animals are not nature's machines, but rather deserve full rights as psychological participants in the moral community of humankind. Tom Reagan's book on the case for animal rights was published by the University of California Press and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Tell me, for instance, Tom Reagan, our conversation is about your book, The Case for Animal Rights. Tell me your reaction as a philosopher, as an academician who makes the case for animal rights. How did you react to the Baby Fay medical episode? Did you think that there was injustice on the side of the baboon who died so that kid could, that child would live for what, a week or two?
Well, to begin with, I thought, from what I know, and still think from what I know, that the first victim of injustice was Baby Fay herself. And the reason I think that is, again, from what I know, or think I know, is that rather than looking for, the best thing that could have been done for the child was to have found a human donor heart and to have done a human heart transplant for
that
the baby.
That not being the case.
Right. But the point is, though, that they, so far as we know, the people in charge of the surgery didn't look, didn't ask. Now, whose interests really were at stake here? If Baby Fay's interests were at stake, they would have looked for that heart for Baby Fay. Mm-hmm. But they didn't look for that heart for Baby Fay. I think they had decided they were going to do this baboon heart transplant, and they were looking for somebody to do it with, and this was a case, and I believe they went ahead and they did it. So the first victim of injustice is Baby Fay herself. Now, no one could wish ill to Baby Fay.
Right.
And so when I say what I'm about to say, it doesn't mean that I wish ill for Baby Fay. On the contrary, I wish she had been treated more equitably. But of course, it's consistent and in fact implied by my view that you have to say that it was wrong to kill that baboon to try to save Baby Fay.
What do you say to the parents of Baby Fay who had the consolation and the knowledge at least of a minimal extension of their child's life?
Well, I think what one has to say is that when you tr- try as best you can to do what you think is right, it doesn't always follow that everybody's happy about it.
It's again a question of ends and means.
That's right. Uh-huh. I sometimes give this example to try to run the test just a little bit with people. You know, suppose it was a case where you could save your child's life, but because the circumstances are so peculiar, your neighbor's child would have to be killed. What would you do? And I think when people think about that for a little bit, I think they'd say, well, you know, I'd really be tempted. I think a lot of people would really be tempted, in order to save their child, to have the neighbor's kid killed. But first, and I think when we think about that a little bit more, we think, well, you know, that really is a very heavy thing to admit. Mm-hmm. But two things. Even if we think that is what we would do, it in no way follows that's what we ought to do. After all, the neighborhood's kid's not doing anything. Neighbor's kid's not doing anything, just happens to be there, and you kill a kid. That's a terrible thing to do, it seems to me, on the face of it. But secondly, even if we thought that in some really very, very bizarre cases, that it would be justifiable to kill the neighbor's kid in order to save our kid, really bizarre cases, I don't think anyone listening to this program would say, well, what we should do because of that, because we think in these bizarre cases it would be justified, what we should do is we should have a system. Mm-hmm. Just day in and day out, we should be killing neighborhood kids.
Right.
But see, that's what we do with the animals. The baboon was killed because the baboon's part of that ongoing system. Three animals killed every second in America's laboratories in the name of science, in the name of human health, in the name of product safety, and so on. So to take it in isolation is a little misleading. It's part of the system.
Do you see yourself as a missionary, Tom Reagan?
Well, a missionary is a more romantic notion, I guess, than the one I would think of. I do see myself as part of, as in some ways on the leading edge of a movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is no question that the animal rights movement is getting stronger. It's getting better organized. We are making a significant progress.
It's a curious combination of both philosophy as well as practical social concerns.
Right.
How do you separate those two?
Well, I think my major contribution has always been and continues to be academic. There are people, there are organizations.
This is to say suggesting the theories. Is that what you mean?
No.
When you
say academic. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Mine has been to write books. It's been to do things like this. And a decade ago in America's colleges and universities, in philosophy classes, I don't think there was a single student discussing animal rights. Mm-hmm. Now today, after a decade's work, the number of students who do this semester in and semester out is in the tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 students a year now. And the reason that they are discussing the issue, I'm not saying they're all animal rights activists, but they're discussing the issue, just as like they're discussing abortion and the death penalty and euthanasia and famine and nuclear power, these issues of the day, is because philosophers have worked hard to create materials, to put them into books that are being used in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And over the past decade, that's what I've worked to do. I've put my major contribution to the movement has been in the academic front.
Tom Reagan, you have written a book called The Case for Animal Rights. Let's conclude our conversation. What should people know about animal rights?
I think that they should start to look at the literature. And of course, I would hope that they'd start with my book and be patient with it. It is a piece of scholarship, and it's not something that you're going to read when you go to bed with Johnny Carson at the same time. It's going to take some work, I think. The stakes are very high, though. We're talking about the question of justice in a neglected area. So I think the first thing they might try to do is to begin to read some of the theoretical background for the case for animal rights. But secondly, and no less importantly, I think they should begin to inform themselves as to what is actually going on in the world. Mm-hmm. That, for example, when they sit down and they have that bacon in the morning, or they have that hamburger in the afternoon, or they have that veal in the evening, that there is a history behind that item on their plate, and that the history of that item is characterized by severe deprivation, severe suffering, severe alienation, that this thing is a product of a system that regards animals, treats animals as a replaceable commodity, as a thing, and that to the extent that the people are buying that product, they're supporting that exploitation. So I think they should begin begin with the food on your plate. Tolstoy had a wonderful essay called The First Step, and he thought in the essay he said, what do we do? How do we, as human beings, take charge of our life? How do we begin to make a conscientious effort to take responsibility for our moral character? Here we are at this point in our life. How do we begin this? And he sought for various options, explored various options, and he said, the thing that occurred to him, the first step is to refuse on principle to eat animals. And he thought that this was a very important step, the first step, because it was a step you could take three times a day again. Mm-hmm. It would signal to yourself and to the world that you were taking charge of your life, that you were, as a matter of conscience and principle, not doing something. And out of that first step, he thought, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles has begun. But it was something that signified that you were going to take the be on the side of the weak against the strong, the oppressed against the oppressor. Mm-hmm. It's a marvelous beginning.
Tom Reagan, a footnote to that final question. I don't want to end particularly on a gloomy note, but I must ask you, do you feel like an alien? Do you feel like an outcast? Do you feel strange in American society taking this philosophical position that you have?
I don't think so, because I meet enough people who either are like-minded. There are enough of those around that if I were the only one, if I was a flat earther and said the earth is flat and I was the only one saying that,
right,
then I probably would feel very alien. But there are enough people, and the numbers are growing all the time, who say, you know, I think there is the feel of truth here.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a tragic symptom of mistakes we've made as a culture. Not the only mistake, but an important one. So there are enough people who are saying there is something true here. And even amongst those who are not saying it's true, there is an increasing number willing to listen.
It's refreshing to hear an academician, a moral philosopher, use a word like truth, and to use it in the fashion that you have.
Well, it's only because I believe it.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Professor Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University about his book, The Case for Animal Rights, published in 1983 by the University of California Press. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Tom Reagan is working on a new book about the English moral philosopher, G.E. Moore. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about scientists and social responsibility. My guest will be another scholar at the National Humanities Center, Alan Byerchin of Ohio State University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.